thanks for listening to the NPR Politics Podcast. During the thick of the holidays, when you're ready for a break or some alone time, there's a bunch more NPR podcasts you should check out. Comedy and pop culture, creative storytelling, and insights into economics and the hidden forces that shape us. Find all our NPR podcasts at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. And enjoy the holidays.
Okay, that was no. Hey, y'all. It's the NPR Politics Podcast here with a New Year's Eve edition of our weekly roundup. And the new year is what we're talking about today. It may not sound different, but I'm coming to you today from Iowa City, Iowa. And Asma, you're somewhere else as well.
Yeah, that's right. I'm Asma Khalid. I cover demographics in the campaign. And today I'm in Boston, but all week I've been crisscrossing the Granite State being New Hampshire.
Cool. And we got two others.
Here in D.C., I'm Domenico Montanaro, political editor.
And I'm Jessica Taylor. I'm a digital political reporter.
Cool. So who has New Year's resolutions? Anybody?
Well, I could jump in, I guess. You know, as the New Yorker in the bunch, I'm always told to look at the bright side here among DCers who always want to make me feel like I should be more positive. So, okay, I'll try to be more positive, whatever.
You're a pretty positive guy from what I know, from what I see.
Well, except
I feel
when
like I'm grumpier than you are.
Except when I'm not. That's okay. Why we all balance each other out. It's fine.
Yeah. Who else has resolutions?
So last year we went on a family vacation around New Year's, and so my sister made us all sit down and verbally talk about these to each other. I can testify that I stuck to none of the resolutions, and I think this year is just there's no hope. It's not even a point in trying to go through that process.
Uh-huh.
I think.
What about you, Jessica?
I'm going to try to go to yoga more. Where I can not think about politics for a while. I love politics, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't be here if I didn't, but, you know, zen out for a little bit. Not
bad in a campaign year.
That is good.
Exactly. Plus, it could get you to connect more to Hillary Clinton, apparently.
Yeah.
Wait, explain.
Maybe Hillary, she does yoga on the campaign trail.
Haven't
she
you read her emails?
Yeah.
I never read those things. I don't read any of those campaign
emails. Well, you should at least read Jessica's write-ups of her emails.
Oh, come on. I shall.
There will be
I
more
shall,
coming I on shall. Thursday. That's uh-huh. It's her little year-end present to us. It's the
there
last day of every month.
Cool. All right, first topic up, the reason for the season and the reason for our separation today, me here in Iowa and Asma in New England. It's all because Iowa and New Hampshire are about to be the focus of the political world for the early part of the new year. Right, Domenico?
That's right. Iowa kicks off February 1st with its caucuses, a very fun process of everyone kind of moving to their own corners and trying to get everyone on board. And then you have New Hampshire, the first in the nation primaries, as they put it, February 9th. So it feels like we're starting to kick things off, Sam.
Yeah. And we have to point out that a caucus and a primary are two very different things, right?
They are.
I spoke with David Yepsen. He's a veteran columnist from the Des Moines Register. He was there for like 34 years.
Good
he
person
like
to talk
the
to.
Guy with, he was great. He is the guy with Iowa politics. We spoke at the legendary Drake Diner in Des Moines, and he told me actually about the roots of the word caucus.
In a caucus, it's a neighborhood meeting. In fact, the term caucus is thought to be a Native American term, an Algonquin term for a meeting of tribal leaders.
And I did not know that.
Yeah, so if you think about it, it very much is a meetings of the Democratic tribe and the Republican tribe, and the local leaders all get together and they talk about issues and who's going to knock on doors.
And it's a meeting. So, like, folks get together at these caucus sites and they talk about why their guy should get the votes and why you should pick their person. And on the Democratic side, correct me if I'm wrong, Domenico, if your guy does not get 15% at that caucus site on the first go round, then you're up for grabs and other folks talk to you again, try to convince you to go to their side.
You got
so
it.
This is not just a vote.
Yeah, there's a 15% threshold. The key here in the caucus is there's no secret ballot. You know, it's not like we go to the polls and we drop something in a box or hit the optical scan button or pull a lever or whatever. You go basically to a gym or to a library or someone's house, and everyone kind of gets in their corner. You argue it out. You talk about who should be on whose side. Then everyone kind of gathers. Now, you know, Martin O'Malley, he's going to have to worry about whether or not he can clear the 15% threshold when it comes to the Democratic side. And let's say one or two people go to his corner or something just shy of 15%, then when they re-caucus on the second round, if you're not at 15%, then his supporters get to go to somebody else, and he will be disqualified in that precinct.
And that's just on the Democratic
side.
That's
the Democratic
side. Republicans do it a little differently.
Yeah.
Because some of them, you still gather at a certain time. And one reason that this is so important is to get these people out is this isn't where you can just go cast an absentee ballot. You can't just go on your lunch break and vote because you have to physically be there between 7 and 9 p.m. And again, this is the middle of winter. You might have something else going on. It really takes a commitment to do this. And Republicans, they'll have their speeches, try to still convince people, but they will, most places, still write down who they're voting for, place it
in a box.
So
it is more secret than the Dems.
It is a little bit more in most of them, yes.
But there's still public speeches.
It's essentially just a straw poll where they count heads or they fold up a piece of paper and pass it in. So it is a little different. There isn't the 15% threshold. It's more of a, you know, maybe how you'd vote in student government or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, the fact that this is a caucus, it means that these candidates have to have a really good ground game and get folks organized and get them to go out the night of. I asked a few people that I've spoken to this week who has the biggest, strongest, toughest ground game that they've seen. And a lot of folks have been telling me that the three with the strongest ground games are Ted Cruz, Bernie Sanders, and Hillary Clinton. Does that sound right to you guys?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially considering the conservative right, the religious right that you have to win. And, you know, a lot of reporters don't make it out of the Des Moines bubble. But if you go 4 hours west to Sioux City and all the way up to the South Dakota border in places like Rock Rapids and Orange is where you'll find and measure the depth of someone like Ted Cruz's devotion, where you'll have lots of evangelical voters show up. And that's where Ted Cruz is really turning out a lot of folks. Donald Trump has been trying to get on board and set up an organization in the state. They've been much better than they were in September. In about October, they started to ramp it up a little bit. But Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, for sure, on the Democratic side, have very strong turnout operations for very different reasons. I mean, Hillary Clinton has the money. She's got the machine. She's done it before. She lost before, which helps you to not repeat the same mistakes. And Bernie Sanders has a lot of that grassroots support of just, you know, Iowa was started as a caucus as an anti-war state.
Exactly.
White liberals, older white liberals. And Bernie Sanders is getting those older white liberals and he's getting younger white liberals.
And I must say, I have seen more Sanders bumper stickers and signs across the state than for any other candidate. And I've driven across the whole state this week.
I mean, always remember that. I think that they're very vocal and passionate. Yes. They're very easy to be found. But with Hillary Clinton, I think one thing that's interesting that I would not want to diminish, because I think I heard this a lot up in New Hampshire as well, is that, you know, she is a candidate who has done this before. She is highly experienced, and she has an extremely effective and efficient machine. And even though she did not win in Iowa,
that infrastructure remains.
She is a candidate to learn from her mistakes.
Yeah. So, think, you know, Trump seems to be the big variable here. You know, some people will say, oh, you just can't see his ground game yet. Like, it's there. He's putting in so much money. And, you know, he does have as his top Iowa strategist the guy who ran Rick Santorum's campaign 4 years ago, who was sort of the surprise Iowa winner getting people out.
So we do have some tape of Trump seeming to take a more, I guess, urgent tone and asking people to get out there on caucus night for him.
The most important thing I can tell you is this. It starts on February 1st. There are so many people back here that say that, you know, Trump gets the biggest rallies by far. But we don't know if those people are going to go caucus. We don't know where they're going to be. We think they're going to sit home and we this and we that. And they all say, well, I agree that if they actually went out, Trump would win easily Iowa.
And that's the question. Will they come out?
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I don't think that that's something that is necessarily unique to Iowa. I heard a very similar message in New Hampshire. But I think this idea of asking voters to actually go out and vote in his stump speech is somewhat of a new line. I think traditionally we heard Donald Trump often begin his speeches by giving you kind of a rundown of the latest poll numbers. When I heard him on Monday night, he began his speech and he ended his speech asking people to go out and vote.
The dates wrong, right?
Yeah, and he actually struggled to get the date right one of the first times he mentioned it.
I just finished by saying this. It's so important that on February 8th, 9th.
So you can't hear it fully, but the crowd actually corrected him and yelled back, you know, February 9th. And I don't think anybody
was upset
with it.
It's like when the rock star goes to, like, Ohio and says, hello, Miami.
You have to realize that we're a month out. So, of course, all of their stump speeches are going to change to try to get people to go to the polls. Now it's going to become action-oriented.
Yeah. I mean, we have seen him ramping up more lately. And he said this week that, you know, he is going to start spending. That's the fascinating thing. He spent so little compared to, you know, what Jeb Bush has been spending in ads that really haven't paid off and things. He says now, he said last night he'll spend $2 million a week, you know, on ads. And, you know, we'll see how much maybe some of that goes into the ground game, into, you know, more things. But I think his ads will be one of the most fascinating things to watch. You know, are they clips from his rallies, or is it where he's going to maybe
clips
explain more about his policies? Is he going to go, you know, just scorched earth against, you know, the candidate he hates most that week? Because it kind of seems to change.
Yeah.
Wait, can I ask real quick, Jess? I didn't realize it's $2 million a week.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was a week.
On his campaign, though,
a lot of money.
But his campaign has said that essentially they're keeping that in reserve until somebody attacks him, and they anticipate that he's going to be attacked, and that when he's attacked, he'll punch back hard.
Let's talk New Hampshire for a bit. The primary in that state is much simpler than Iowa. Who wants to explain the difference for us?
I mean, it's a simple primary. I mean, it's in the sense
just vote.
you just go up, you show up, you vote. And on top of that, I mean, it's even easier in some ways because there are many people who are undeclared voters here, meaning basically they don't identify as a Democrat or a Republican. You can pick and choose who you want to subscribe to on a particular day.
I mean, the major point about New Hampshire is that it's an open primary, and it has one of the largest groups of independents in the country. More than 40% of the people in the state see themselves or declare themselves as undeclared or as independents. And what that means is that what usually happens is there's some measure of that middle group of moderates who might, you know, vote in a Republican primary or might vote in a Democratic primary, but depending on which one or which candidate, they would cross over and vote. And that slice of independents winds up making New Hampshire a more quote-unquote establishment state.
And also somewhat more representative of the rest of the country in a way.
But yeah, it is a swing state in addition.
That is totally true. And one of the things that I, you know, hear from people sometimes is that New Hampshire picks winners, Iowa picks corn. You know, that's sort of the joke that they like to say there.
But they picked Obama.
But I guess amongst the Republicans.
We're talking two different things here. Democrats, certainly, Iowa's been a launch pad. But if you look at Iowa's track record on the Republican side, it's only picked three of the last seven or eight presidents.
I mean, New Hampshire's had a fairly solid track record.
Yeah.
And so Donald Trump's been leading in the polls in New Hampshire for quite some time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the big question is going to be whether or not Donald Trump can sustain that over the next month, because these things do change and can change quickly. The other thing to watch here is who winds up being the top establishment pick. It's not going to be Donald Trump. It's going to be somebody like Marco Rubio, John Kasich, or Chris Christie, Jeb Bush. Among those four, whoever takes the top spot among them is where people are looking to whether or not they will actually become the potential nominee.
And guys, one other important thing that I wanted to mention about New Hampshire is that on Monday, former President Bill Clinton is going to be coming to New Hampshire to campaign for his wife.
The big dog is back.
The big dog.
I mean, he was one of Democrats' best assets on the campaign trail in past years and stuff, too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's a good asset for his wife and sort of firing up that Democratic base.
Even Mitt Romney said in 2012 that when Bill Clinton says nice things about you, you get a bump. So he's someone who can rally a lot of those New Hampshire Democrats who voted for him, where he was dubbed the comeback kid.
Right.
And certainly the South is going to be a big deal in Democratic primaries. And, you know, he can appeal to blue-collar white voters in a way that maybe his wife and Barack Obama haven't been able to.
I mean, of course, whenever Bill Clinton comes back on the stage, you could end up talking about previous things that he's done.
That's exactly what Donald Trump brought up this week, you know, saying he put out a flurry of tweets saying, you know, Bill Clinton's history of sexism and referring to, you know, allegations of affairs and the Monica Lewinsky scandal and different things, too. But I mean, but then Trump, of course, who has admitted to his own affair, even admitted last night that, you know, this stuff, his own indiscretions could be fair game as well, too.
But look, Bill Clinton's past, of course, is going to be fair game, as are any of the campaign, you know, principals or spouses. But whether or not it's going to make much of a difference, I'm very doubtful, because, you know, people know his history. They know the Clinton's history. You know, if you liked him, then you're going to overlook it and talk about the Clinton economy of the 90s. And if you don't like him, then you're going to think it's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. So the other thing to talk about this week is the U.S. Senate. We've been talking about the presidential race for a couple of months now, but control of the Senate is also at stake in 2016. And Jessica, you've been covering this. Why is this a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal because control is very much on the line. So Republicans just picked back up control of the Senate after several years of trying to get it back in these last elections. And now that was a very good cycle for Republicans. Certainly, it's a midterm year where they do better than in presidential years, but they also were defending far less seats. Last time, Democrats were defending 21 seats while Republicans just had 15 up. Now, this time, it's the mirror image of that. Republicans are defending 24 seats compared to just 10 for Democrats. Now, remember,
that's a big deal.
It's a big deal. Yeah. And these were seats that they won in 2010, which was a great year for Republicans. They took back the House. You saw the rise of the Tea Party. And these senators in some of these blue states were able to win. And now you're facing a much different electorate. It's not a midterm electorate. It's a presidential electorate that favors Democrats more. And they've got to sort of campaign on what is going to be more hostile territory.
I think, though, part of what will be at stake, and I'd be curious to see what plays out, is that when we have the presidential election, people are going to be selecting a presidential candidate at the same time that they will be voting for a senator. And we've seen so much debate this year around sort of both what the Democrats have to say and what the Republicans have to say, that I wonder how some of the conversations around the presidential candidates could filter down.
I mean, that's exactly. I've been talking to a lot of Republicans this week, and we'll have a story coming out just on this, how they're so worried that if Trump is the nominee, if Cruz even is the nominee, that they're very worried about the top of the ticket in states like Florida, like
Ohio. So who would they
Ohio.
Want to win?
Most of them want Rubio, really. I mean, you know, you won't hear a lot of people say that on the record, of course. But, you know, they see him sort of as this, he has the Barack Obama charisma that helped them.
And just raw numbers, right? I mean,
he
winds up with a broader appeal to Hispanics than any of the candidates when you look at polling.
Yeah.
And what's key about this is Republicans have worked so hard for the past decade to win governor's races so that they could control redistricting. They've worked very hard to take over the House. They won back the Senate in 2014. If they were to hold the Senate and have a president who was a Republican, they would control the entire structure. Now, if they wind up with a nominee who's too far to the right, as they see it, like a Cruz or a Trump, then you're looking at Florida, Wisconsin, Illinois, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, maybe even Ohio. You know, maybe they hold Nevada. And that gives Democrats the Senate with a Democratic president.
So, in terms of policy, if the Senate flips, what big policy changes could we expect, if any?
I mean, I think you'd see a lot of gridlock, really. I mean, this coming year is a presidential year, of course, and they don't get a lot done typically, and Congress doesn't do a lot. They're not in session very often. You know, I think that, you know, you wouldn't see certainly more Obamacare repeals and things too in the Senate. You wouldn't do that. If it flips back to there, it would be harder to get through any sort of, you know, government funding measure.
Would it not be sort of back to where we were? I mean, where
it
we
would
had
be.
The Senate passing immigration reform, but then immigration reform.
Exactly. You'd have a lot of things originating maybe in the Senate. There are Democratic priorities dying in the House, or things that Republicans want to do in the House dying in the Senate. And, you know, we're back at gridlock.
If you wind up, though, with a Democratic Senate, you won't have Republicans in the House feeling like they can push through anything they want, and then the Republican Senate will take it up and they can, you know, essentially say Congress is against the president doesn't want to compromise. This puts a lot more pressure on the Republican-controlled House that will likely still remain Republican-controlled if there were to be we're looking at two. If Democrats win back the Senate, you're also probably looking at a Democratic president. So you would wind up with a Democrat in the White House, a Democratic-controlled Senate, and more pressure back on the Republican House, which definitely hurts the national agenda for Republicans.
You know, for the House,
I mean, but does it not hurt the agenda, though, in general, though? I mean, because, Domenico, that kind of feels like deja vu.
Yeah, well, look, it is always deja vu, especially in the Senate where you have 60 votes essentially to do anything, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw Barack Obama get most of what he got done because he had that 60th vote in the Senate. Mm-hmm. He got health care through because of that. But, you know, these things move incrementally. They move very slowly back to a position, you know, that moves things in a direction that one party controls the agenda. If you had Republicans at 54 votes where they are now and they picked up a few more seats and then another cycle down the line picked up a few more seats, now suddenly they are in firm control with 60 votes and you have have a president to then push through their agenda. These things take time, but that's why Democrats are hopeful that they can move things back to something closer to 50-50.
Okay, good luck, senators. Now it's time for Can't Let It Go, where we all share something we can't stop thinking about this week, politics or otherwise. Who's going first? Asma?
So I am going to bring my Can't Let It Go from the trail where I was with Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire. I was in Portsmouth, and she was doing this town hall there, and about three of the questions she took out of the group came from little kids. And, you know, she's been doing this a lot. I think we mentioned something in the podcast the other week about a question that she was asked on the campaign trail from a little kid about getting bullied, right? And it's sort of so opportune, I think people asked that time, and certainly we had questions after the most recent incident as well. You know, are these kids plants? Are they really legit? You know, is Hillary Clinton screening these questions? So I want you to take a listen to the question that was asked to her by this little girl. Her name was Ella Briggs, and she's 7 years old, a second grader.
Hi, I'm Ella. I think that there's a lot of people who don't have enough money for college and schools and that kind of stuff. So how can we help that?
It's a very good question, Ella.
Plant.
No.
So plant. What do you guys think? I mean, that's what makes
she's a very precocious little girl.
And clearly engaged parents, let's be honest. I mean,
well, also, like, it's always girls, though, right? Like, it's always girls.
No, I think that says something.
At this event, there were two little boys that also raised their hand asked questions at Hillary. And so I think the explanation that Hillary Clinton gives in selecting questions from children is that she feels like this election is about the future. It's about their generation, and so she enjoys taking questions from
kids.
She's
a grandmother.
Right. Don't forget. This is grandma thing.
So in a nutshell, afterwards, I went up to the Clinton campaign. I asked them, you know, do you pre-screen questions? Is there any sort of filtering process? They insisted that no, there's not. And anyhow, jump ahead. I'm at my hotel working on a story, and lo and behold, I happen to bump in to Ella and her family. We got to talking, and she really is a smart, clever little kid who's clearly heard a lot of this type of conversation around her before. Both of her parents are high school teachers. And I asked her why she's such a fan of Hillary Clinton, and this is what she said.
I've heard that she wants little children's health care to be awesome. And I've heard that she wants poor people to get more money so they can have houses.
Look, we're going to see Ella on the ballot one day in about, like, 20 years.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Democrats always need young voters, but, you know, she's still too young to vote next time, but I guess you'll have to keep your eye on her.
I asked her parents, you know, are they Hillary Clinton supporters? Mom is. Dad says he's leaning towards Bernie Sanders. And so I asked her what she thought about Bernie Sanders, and she told me the only thing she knows is that he is the older individual in this race.
That might be what you know, some voters who can vote might think of him, but, you know.
So, Jessica, what can you not let go this week?
So I've been listening to a lot of these Donald Trump rallies, and there was one last a statement that he made last night in Iowa that sort of really stuck out at me. In Iowa, if you want to be successful in the caucuses, you have to win the evangelical vote. And this is a statement that he made that sort of seemed like a little bit of a coded attack against Ted Cruz, who is leading him in some polls there now. So I think we have the clip here.
You got to remember, in all fairness, to the best of my knowledge, not too many evangelicals come out of Cuba. Okay, just remember that. Okay, just remember.
It just really isn't grounded in fact or anything, it doesn't seem like. And, you know, I just did a quick Google search this morning, you know, Cuba evangelicals, and there's a lot of stories about how the number of evangelicals there is growing. And, you know, the whole point of evangelicism is to convert people. So it shouldn't matter where they come from.
That actually might be why Donald Trump's done so well with evangelicals early on, because not that many evangelicals come out of Queens either, speaking as someone who's from Queens. And I can tell you that they're probably giving him a look saying, all right, maybe we can win this guy over, you know?
Right. And, you know,
but, like, what is he really trying to do? Because wouldn't the better way to make inroads with this community be to pray in public or throw out some scriptures?
Well,
or
he's
talk
been
about
asked
he
to do
God.
All of that. He's been asked
Does
to
he
do
that?
All of that. He doesn't. I mean, he was asked, you know, his favorite book of the Bible. He demurred. Even he was asked to choose between his favorite New Testament. I mean, you got Testament.
Just say
you
Revelation.
Have two choices there.
As someone who was raised evangelical, you can't trick us. Like, you can't fake the funk on
right,
that.
Right. No, I was too, yeah. Sam, and that's exactly right. You know, I think that's why sort of, you know, my meter went up. I was like, this is not anything you would hear in an evangelical church.
All right. So, Domenico, what could you not let go this week?
Well, Donald Trump, since we're talking about Donald Trump, he continues to talk about everybody else. And he was talking about Bill Clinton this week. He started to talk about his dalliances in the past and how that's fair game. Well, here's the thing. There was a time when Republicans actually liked Bill Clinton not that long ago. It was just the last presidential election. And I think we have a clip from The Daily Show on that.
Under Clinton, you had a president who was willing to compromise.
Bill Clinton, who you depict in your book.
Yes.
He was a flexible guy.
He learned how to compromise with conservatives to get things done.
If he's willing to work with us, as Bill Clinton did after the 1994 elections, to pass things like welfare reform, trade agreements, and the like, we'll certainly work with him.
That's right. Republican darling Bill Clinton. Now, some of you may be too young to remember the feel-good 1990s, when a universally respected President Clinton reigned over an 8-year bipartisan love fest.
Well, Trevor Noah's great, but, you know, there's only one John Stewart, right? You heard in that clip Rudy Giuliani, John Cornyn, among other Republicans, all praising Bill Clinton during the 2012 election as a way to hit Barack Obama, to say, boy, if we only had a president like Bill Clinton again. You know, it's just amazing how these things just come around. I guess presidents are
short-term memories.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's like presidents are like wine, I guess, or something. You know, better the further away from their presidencies. I don't know.
I actually have two things that I can't let go this week.
Sam,
maybe
so
they both
greedy.
Make the cut, maybe they don't, but I'm going to just go there. First, hashtag poor Martin. Martin O'Malley has had two solo sightings this week, one documented by our colleague Sarah McCammon, who was traveling across the country this week, saw O'Malley in the same airport she was. He was literally all by himself in a busy airport and was recognized by only two people, one of whom was a campaign journalist. She put a photo up on her Facebook of Martin O'Malley in his nice suit, looking handsome as he always does, just by himself. It was real sad. Then, a few days later, he was in a small town only like 75 miles west of where I am doing this event. There was some snow this week. He says that's the reason why this happened, but honestly, it's just par for the course for Martin. One person shows up. And Martin just talks to that guy for a while.
That's
You
weird.
Feel really bad for Martin O'Malley. He just
But in some ways,
can't
that's so respectable that he, you know, spent the time talking to that one guy.
Every voter is important.
But
the fascinating thing about this story is then people talk. There was another one reporter, I think, there that made it there and talked with this guy, and he's still not sold on Martin O'Malley.
What does Martin have to do? Does Martin have to go wash this dude's car and mow his lawn to get a vote?
Well, he's
got somebody help Martin out.
You know, but candidates, I remember traveling in 2008 and 2012, and you wind up seeing – it's kind of weird at the Des Moines airport because you do wind up seeing these candidates just kind of hanging out there with a very small entourage. And, you know, it's kind of strange because you're not usually that close to people who are running in the campaign. But for one person to show up at an event, just one – that tells you a whole lot more about his candidacy.
And it wasn't just the snow, because I was up here in Iowa, and I was driving in that snow, and it was not like a blizzard of all blizzards.
I was covering Hillary Clinton in snow, and it was not great weather. I mean, it was snowy, the roads were slick, and there were lines out the door of the church.
Yeah, I mean, these people who go to the Bernie Sanders rally is very passionate. Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, I mean, these people, they would brave the snow for this. Apparently this one guy was the only one who would brave the snow for Martin O'Malley.
So my second can't let it go. Is that okay? It'd be really quick, I promise.
There's another one?
There's another one.
No, that was two.
I thought that was two.
No, that was two of the same thing with Martin. This is Aretha Franklin, the queen. So who watched the Kennedy Center Honors?
I didn't, but I saw this clip. This clip was quite amazing.
Yeah, so Carole King, famous songwriter, was honored at the Kennedy Center Honors. She wrote the song, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. Aretha Franklin came on stage to perform the song, walks on stage in this, like, full fur coat, looking regal as she does. Before she even starts to sing or perform, Obama is literally wiping away tears from his eyes. So Aretha sits down to play the piano as she sings, and then Carole King like loses it and is like, oh my gosh, she's gonna play the piano too. It's amazing. So she goes into this song. It's beautiful and epic, and Aretha Franklin's voice has not sounded this good in probably 15 years. So uninspired. But she is singing this song. Halfway through, she gets up, walks up towards her like background singers, and starts to pull the fur coat off. And then raises her arms and is singing to the rafters. And at this point, George Lucas is I'm like in the crowd catching the spirit. Carole King is about to fall over the banister. Obama and Michelle are up on their feet like they're in church. I mean, it is just spiritual. Like, it was my favorite moment of this week, probably this month. And if there was any doubt, the queen is still on the throne. Aretha Franklin can bring it. Y'all gotta watch this clip, though. It's so perfect. It's so perfect. It's like, it made me be like, who is Adele? Who? What is that? Huh? Who? Adele who?
Happy holidays, Sam. I'm glad that made you feel good.
It did. So that's all I got. That's it. Couldn't let it go. All right, that is all the time we have for this week. Thank you for listening. Happy New Year. Let us know if you like the show. Find us on Twitter and catch our political coverage on your local public radio station as well. I'm Sam Sanders, campaign reporter.
I'm Asma Khalid. I cover demographics and politics.
Domenico Montanaro, political editor.
And I'm Jessica Taylor, a digital political reporter.
All right, we'll see you next year on the NPR Politics Podcast.